This is VOA News. I'm Richard Green. Handheld radios used by Hezbollah detonated Wednesday across Lebanon South and in the suburbs of the capital, Beirut, further stoking tensions with Israel a day after similar explosions by the group's pagers. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn reports.
The death toll from Tuesday's pager explosions rose to 12, including two children, with nearly 3,000 injured. At a funeral for four of those killed by the exploding pagers, Hezbollah official Hashem Saifedean promised a response.
This aggression inevitably has its own punishment. It has its own retribution. This punishment will come, God willing. We will not talk much, as tomorrow the talk will be for the master of the resistance.
A senior Lebanese security source said the explosives were planted months earlier by Israel's spy agency, Mossad. Israel's military has declined to comment on the blasts.
That was Christy Kilburn reporting for Reuters. White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby said Wednesday the U.S. remains involved in intense diplomatic efforts to prevent an escalation of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon.
All I can tell you is we're still putting our shoulder to the wheel to get the hostages home and get a ceasefire in place, as daunting as that is today. And we are still involved in intensive diplomacy to try to prevent a second front from opening up on that border with Lebanon.
Kirby said the U.S. was not involved in the device blast. Join VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises as we delve into the heart of the world's most pressing conflicts and crises, from the Israel-Hamas war to the Russia-Ukraine war, as well as regional hotspots spanning from Asia to Africa and beyond. That's VOA's Flashpoint. This is VOA News. Jerome Powell, the chairman of the U.S. Federal Reserve, rejected suggestions Wednesday that politics played a role in its decision to cut interest rates by half a point. The move comes weeks before the November presidential and congressional elections. Here's AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Donald Trump has argued lowering rates now amounts to political interference. But for Powell,
this is my fourth presidential election at the Fed,
and nothing changes.
We're always going into this meeting in particular and asking what's the right thing to do for the people we serve.
Powell says that's it, serving the people, not any politician or cause or issue.
It's never about anything else. Nothing else is discussed.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Nigeria's Hydrological Services Agency has warned of potential flooding in 11 states after neighboring Cameroon said it was starting to release water from one of its largest dams following recent heavy rainfall in West and Central Africa. Reuters correspondent Arthi Thayaparan has more.
Nigeria's hydrological group said it was notified by authorities in Cameroon that they had started controlled water releases from Lagdo Dam, one of its largest. Cameroon has several dams on the Benue River, which flows downstream to Nigeria. The Nigerian side says dam managers in Cameroon plan to release water gradually to prevent flooding, but it's urging state and federal authorities to be prepared. The country is already grappling with severe floods in the northeastern Borno state after a dam's walls burst from heavy rains. Nigeria is prone to flooding, but critics say defective infrastructure and poor planning add to the problem.
That was Reuters correspondent Arthi Thayaparan. In 2022, more than 600 people died during Nigeria's worst flooding in a decade that was also triggered by heavy rains. Cameroon released water from the same dam at that time. U.S. entertainment mogul Sean Diddy Combs remains in jail after a second federal judge denied his request to be released on bail Wednesday, 2 days after he was arrested on sex trafficking charges. Here's AP entertainment reporter Margie Zaraletta.
A day after federal magistrate Robin F. Tarnovsky ruled that Sean Diddy Combs was too dangerous to go free, U.S. District Judge Andrew L. Carter also denied bond for Combs. Carter says prosecutors gave convincing evidence that Combs could potentially tamper with witnesses. Combs pleaded not guilty on Tuesday to charges that include racketeering, sex trafficking, obstruction of justice, and drug offenses. Combs' attorney had offered to post $50 million bail for home detention at Combs' mansion in Miami. Combs has been held at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn since his arraignment.
That was AP Entertainment reporter Margie Zaraletta. For more on this and all the stories we're covering, visit us at voanews.com. I'm Richard Green for VOA News.
central bank lowers its key interest rate as inflation eases.
It sends a signal to the central banks around the world, to countries like India, that maybe it's time for you also to cut interest rates.
Celebrating the first president to reach 100 years old.
This is the first time ever that people have come together to celebrate the 100th birthday of an American president.
And an American business icon declares bankruptcy.
By doing so, it has likely sealed the fate of the so-called Tupperware lady.
Today is Thursday, September 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
Today, the Federal Open Market Committee decided to reduce the degree of policy restraint by lowering our policy interest rate by a half percentage point.
The U.S. Federal Reserve cut interest rates by half a percentage point on Wednesday, kicking off what's expected to be a steady easing of monetary policy. The half-point reduction is larger than usual, but not unprecedented, Fed Chairman Jerome Powell.
Our patient approach over the past year has paid dividends. Inflation is now much closer to our objective, and we have gained greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably toward 2%.
U.S. stocks gained following release of the statement.
Other central banks around the world have cut, many of them several times. We've waited, and I think that that patience has really paid dividends in the form of our confidence that inflation is moving sustainably down to 2%.
The rate cut is good news for both consumers and for businesses because it makes borrowing money cheaper. Joining us now to help explain why is Professor David Kass from the University of Maryland Robert H. Smith School of Business. So thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So explain to us what the Federal Bank did.
Basically, the Federal Reserve announced a reduction in the federal funds rate. It's an overnight interest rate by 50 basis points, or one half of a percentage point, lowering the overnight rate, which had been in a range of 5.25% to 5.5%, now reducing it to 4.75% to 5%. All experts, economists, et cetera, expected the Federal Reserve to make an interest rate cut, but a majority actually thought it would be only 25 basis points, or one half of what they actually did. And normally most moves by the Federal Reserve, whether to raise interest rates or lower them, are usually by a quarter of a point. It's unusual to do as much or move as much as a half a point as they did today. They have done that in the past, going in both directions up and down, but it is certainly a minority of moves are that large.
Why did they say they moved a half point instead of a quarter?
Yeah, there was some concern of the Federal Reserve has a dual mandate of maximum employment and price stability. And until now, recently, they've been focusing on the price stability component, that is inflation. Inflation did shoot up right after the pandemic, largely as a result of the pandemic. Interest rates were raised, and now inflation has come down. But now there's a concern in the employment area. The unemployment rate has gone up, from a few months ago, 3.7%. up to 4.2%, and there's some concern that this could result in a recession at some time in the near future. So what the Federal Reserve is doing, they're taking out an insurance policy, so to speak, by lowering interest rates, which in turn will stimulate the economy, encourage more loans and spending by consumers, which should reduce the probability of a recession in the future.
So that's the tightrope the Federal Bank walks, isn't it? On one hand, you want to keep the interest rate low to encourage business. On the other hand, you don't want it to be so low that there's inflation.
That's exactly right. And indeed, most of the recessions that have occurred in the United States in the last several decades have really resulted from the Federal Reserve raising interest rates too far, too fast, in an attempt to fight inflation. And now what the Federal Reserve is attempting and so far achieving is what they call a soft landing, or walking this very fine tightrope between inflation and employment to avoid a recession.
What does this mean? Now, this doesn't only affect, I mean, its initial target is the U.S. economy, but the U.S. economy affects the rest of the world, doesn't it?
It does, and it sends a signal to the central banks around the world. For example, the whole world, of course, was affected by the pandemic at the same time, and in 2020, and it resulted in inflation around the world. And recently, leading the United States, the central banks of UK, European Central Bank, and Canada have already taken the lead and started to cut their interest rates. And now this the action today by the Federal Reserve will send a signal to countries like India that maybe it's time for you also to cut interest rates. There is a certain amount of synchronization, you might around the world, in the sense that there's a large amount of international trade and the world economies are somewhat connected.
This is good news, isn't it?
I think it's excellent news that it's again should lead to economic growth around the world. Inflation appears to be in control in the major countries in Europe and Asia and here in the United States. And I think it's moving in the right direction. And I think the equity markets, which are actually in the United States and around the world, have been doing very well recently, and I think this would be very supportive going forward.
Mm. Thank you so much for the time and the explanation. It's so complicated.
Oh, yes, it's my pleasure. Thank you again for having me.
David Cass from the University of Maryland, Robert H. Smith School of Business. On Wednesday, a day after hundreds of pagers used by the militant group Hezbollah exploded, handheld radios used by the group also began exploding. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn reports this is further raising tension.
Smoke billowed from a cell phone shop in Sidon, Lebanon on Wednesday after handheld radios used by Hezbollah detonated across the country's south. Lebanon's health ministry said several people were killed in the latest attack and hundreds were wounded. The death toll from Tuesday's pager explosions rose to 12, including two children, with nearly 3,000 injured. At a funeral for four of those killed by the exploding pagers, Hezbollah official Hashem Saifuddin promised a response.
This aggression inevitably has its own punishment. It has its own retribution. This punishment will come, God willing. We will not talk much, as tomorrow the talk will be for the master of the resistance.
Hezbollah said on Wednesday it had attacked Israeli artillery positions with rockets in its first strike at its arch foe since the pager blasts. A senior Lebanese security source said the explosives were planted months earlier by Israel's spy agency, Mossad. Israel's military has declined to comment on the blasts.
It's imperative that all parties refrain from any actions that could escalate the conflict.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in Cairo to advance efforts to secure a ceasefire in Gaza, said the detonations in Lebanon threatened to derail diplomatic efforts in the Middle East. Later, U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the incidents risked a dramatic escalation in the region.
Because obviously, the logic of making all these devices explode is to do it as a preemptive strike before a major military operation.
A security source said the handheld radios were purchased by Hezbollah 5 months ago, around the same time the group bought the pagers. Two sources familiar with the group's operations told Reuters its fighters began using pagers, hoping to evade Israeli tracking. A Reuters reporter in the southern suburbs of Beirut said he saw Hezbollah members frantically taking out the batteries of any walkie-talkies on them that had not exploded. Meanwhile, Israel released video on Wednesday that showed Defense Minister Yoav Gallant telling troops that more forces were being sent to the northern border, where Lebanon borders Israel, as the war moved into a new phase.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. A group of young activists in Turkey, known as 1,000 Youth for Palestine, is posing a rare and potent challenge to Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The group is using social media to expose Turkey's ongoing trade with Israel. Erdogan has claimed he imposed a strict trade embargo on Israel over the war in Gaza. But as we hear now from Dorian Jones, the group's message is crossing the deep political, social, and religious divides that exist in Turkey.
The latest protest in Istanbul by the group was over the killing by Israeli security forces of the Turkish-American activist Ayşenur Ezgi Ergi. But along with condemning Israel, the demonstrators also took aim at Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for sustaining Turkey's trade with Israel. Gülsüm is an academic who is part of 1,000 Youth for Palestine. She asked to be identified only by her first name for security reasons.
I'm here to force Turkish government to stop oil trade with Israel, to stop genocide. This is not just a public demand, it is also a legal obligation for Turkey to stop genocide.
The student-based group, since the start of Israel's Gaza military campaign, has targeted the export of Azerbaijani oil to Israel by way of a Turkish port. The group is also protesting Turkish companies continuing trade ties with Israel, despite an official embargo. The group uses social media to broadcast its message, circumventing government-controlled media. Gizem is a university student with 1,000 Youth for Palestine.
When it comes to Palestine, it's a story that unites us all. So we are a group who can easily agree on what we can do for it from here. There are those who define themselves as socialists and those who define themselves as Islamists. There are also a political youth who say, I don't like politics, but still join us.
Police are cracking down on the protests. A state broadcaster panel discussion on Israel was disrupted by the group, resulting in the arrest of a Palestinian member who now faces deportation. The incident sparked more protests. Arresting protesters who are Islamists, analysts say, will likely embarrass Erdogan and alienate his religious base. Analysts accuse Erdogan of exploiting deep divisions between secular and religious Turks and say the group's diversity poses a problem for him. Sezin Öne is a commentator on Turkey's Politikyol news portal.
Such hybrid groups are coming together, united, because of a cause, but ideologically or background-wise or anything-wise, social class-wise, they may be very diverse. And that's something threatening for the government.
Erdogan lost heavily in recent local elections, a defeat widely blamed on a poor economy, but also on anger over Turkey's trade with Israel. Activists say they hope to build on that. Murat is another university student for 1,000 Youth for Palestine. Like the others, he asked to be identified by his first name for security reasons.
The reason for our success is that we put our finger on the right spot. We expose the hypocrisy. We expose the hypocrisy of both the capitalists, the corporations, and the government.
As analysts see it, the group's diversity is clearly a headache for Erdogan, and one that will not go away as long as the war in Gaza and Turkey's engagement with Israel continue. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
following these other stories from around the world. U.S. President Joe Biden will welcome United Arab Emirates President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan to the White House on Monday for talks on issues ranging from the war in Gaza, Sudan, and responsible artificial intelligence development. Peruvian President Dina Boluarte on Wednesday declared a state of emergency in three regions affected by devastating forest fires that have burned through huge chunks of the nation's Andean and Amazonian croplands. 16 people have been killed in the fires. A series of deadly wildfires in Portugal has overwhelmed emergency services there. In the Viseu district, flames near the village of Povoa Montemuro were seen racing through vegetation on Wednesday, threatening the area with alarming speed. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, existing laws governing internet free speech are being questioned across the U.S. political spectrum. VOA's Matt Dibble looks at how candidates Kamala Harris and Donald Trump view the issue.
Would you like now to apologize to the victims?
If there is one thing that both major U.S. political parties agree on, it's that social media companies must change the way they operate. And whoever wins the White House is likely to pursue that goal.
If we don't have free speech, then we just don't have a free country.
On his campaign website, Republican Donald Trump claims that the right to free speech, guaranteed under the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, is being infringed by some social media companies. After the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol, Trump himself was temporarily banned from posting on some sites.
Upon my inauguration as president, I will ask Congress to send a bill to my desk revising Section 230 to get big online platforms out of censorship business.
Section 230, a part of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, has been fundamental in establishing the internet we know today, says Brandy Nonicky, director of a University of California, Berkeley Tech Policy Lab.
It actually empowers platforms to be able to moderate and remove content without a risk of liability. Now, we often hear that the First Amendment is being infringed upon by these platforms. However, the First Amendment only applies to government suppression of speech. The platforms themselves, they are private entities, and they're private entities that they themselves have First Amendment rights.
Earlier attempts to revise Section 230 have faltered. After Trump's accounts were banned in 2021, Florida and Texas, two states with majority Republican electorates, both passed laws limiting the ability of social media companies to police political speech on their sites. But these laws were put on hold this year when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that media companies have the right to make editorial decisions free from government interference.
It was a breeding ground for hate speech against Rohingya refugees.
Politicians from Kamala Harris's Democratic Party often accuse social media companies of allowing too much harmful speech on their platforms. In 2022, Vice President Harris launched a White House task force to address the problem in this recording by C-SPAN.
Hate has become so common on the internet that as a society, it's kind of becoming normalized. And for users, some might say unavoidable.
For now, social media companies' right to control content on their sites remains in place. But for many politicians and citizens, this issue is far from resolved. Matt Dibble, VOA News, Oakland, California.
Sri Lanka's presidential candidates wrapped up their campaigning on Wednesday ahead of Saturday's vote. More than 17 million Sri Lankans are expected to vote, looking for a leader who can address corruption and revitalize the economy as the country faces its worst financial crisis in more than 70 years. More fallout from Venezuela's election. Jorge Rodriguez, a key figure in the ruling Socialist Party and president of the National Assembly, said on Wednesday that opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez willingly signed a letter accepting the court ruling confirming Nicolas Maduro's victory. But Gonzalez says he was forced to sign the document. Also from Venezuela, the public ministry announced on Wednesday that arrest warrants are being processed against Argentina's president, Javier Milei, and two other officials over allegedly stealing an aircraft. The jet was seized by Argentina because it was linked to Iran and it was turned over to the United States. International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Taiwan's government said on Thursday that an executive at major chemicals maker Formosa Plastics has been detained in China. The Mainland Affairs Council, responding to media reports of the executive being stopped at the Chinese border and detained, said it was aware of the detention, though it declined further comment, citing the family's wishes and security. Formosa Plastics said it was in the process of understanding what had happened and also declined to comment. China's Taiwan Affairs Office did not respond to a request for comment immediately.
We were just talking backstage that everyone in here is making history.
On October 1st, Jimmy Carter, the 39th president of the United States, will turn 100 years old. He will become the first American president to reach 100. On that day, the public broadcasting system in the U.S. will broadcast a concert that was recorded this week.
This is the first time ever that people have come together to celebrate the 100th birthday of an American president.
That was one of Carter's grandsons, Jason Carter. Performances included the B-52s, singer B.B. Wyans, and global music icon Angelique Kidjo. Civil rights leader Dr. Bernice King delivered a heartfelt speech, as did actress Renee Zellweger.
100 years of kindness and social responsibility and faith and devotion and inspiring stories. And at the heart of all of it, love.
According to the Carter Center, the eclectic lineup was meant to highlight Carter's emphasis on human rights and his love of music as a universal language. Carter remains in hospice care at his home in Plains, Georgia. And finally, American icon Tupperware Brands filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection this week. The company made food storage containers that were once the undisputed top of the line, and the company was a path for many women to earn a living at a time when there were few opportunities for them in the workplace. Reuters correspondent Lisa Bernard says the company is succumbing to mounting losses because of poor demand for its once iconic product.
Tupperware, whose iconic plastic food containers once filled millions of American kitchens, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The move comes after several years of falling sales and failed turnaround efforts, as demand slipped due to rivals making cheaper and more environmentally friendly containers. The company said it will now chart out a sale process for the business. By doing so, it has likely sealed the fate of the so-called Tupperware lady, the nickname given to a generation of post-war housewives seeking empowerment who sold the plastic products at in-home gatherings known as Tupperware parties. The company enjoyed a brief resurgence during the pandemic as more Americans cooked at home amid travel curbs. But after some wild swings during the meme stock rallies of that period, shares of Tupperware ultimately slumped in 2023 as it delayed annual reports and breached its credit obligations.
Reuters correspondent Lisa Bernard reporting. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA. social media platform, and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Wolterman.